Science fiction is a popular way for human societies to begin to cope with new and disruptive technologies. This week, Techonomics host Jason Middleton speaks with an author about one of the most disruptive, if not disturbing, technologies, artificial intelligence. Part one of two of that conversation starts now.
Hello there and welcome back. Science fiction has always been a precursor to societal shifts that technologies could foist upon us. Think about the holodeck on Star Trek. In several ways, it was a precursor to 3D printing, which, even if you may not witness it every day, it's almost ubiquitous. Also, like droids in Star Wars, having actual contextual conversations with humans and other species. This week, we have an author who takes on artificial intelligence in a way that not only, for lack of a better word, humanizes it, it makes it less scary and shows a way to think about the coming AI world. Here's a summary from producer Liana Wilcox from my pre-interview prep. A spaceship AI finds new life in an illegal artificial body while helping her humanoid friend find her way back to the AI who helped raise her and join society, also happens to be a spaceship AI. It's a really good book. The Science Fiction Chat is part one of two, so please look on kgoradio.com/techonomics for the second podcast segment. And if you're listening on the broadcast, just stick around through the break like you always do, right? Okay, now here's the author to help us out.
Becky Chambers, and the title is A Closed and Common Orbit.
Becky, thank you so much for your time today. We're excited to talk with you, but I have to say that I put a new note at the top of my pre-interview prep, and that is, at looking at the book and reading the book, I realized somebody is treating the masses as if they are mature. You know how, okay, let me start. Because remember back in the day, like, personal computers were going to change our life, right? They're going to make everything. The desktop was going to be everything and make it technologically easy. That was like the 80s into the 90s. And if you go farther back, you probably remember, like I do, the Kitchens of the Future cartoons that would come on.
Yes.
On the way, right? Okay, I'm reading your book. It's a little real life. Like, it's set way in the future. It's got a lot of artificial intelligence going on, but there's still a lot of interface. You treat us like adults, and I appreciate that, because sometimes it just doesn't work, you know, and you have your normal frustrations like you would with anything else. Did that help you with your verisimilitude as you were building this world in your brain?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, what's the most important thing for me when I write in this setting is to make it feel accessible, to make it feel relatable. So in that, yeah, sometimes things need to break and sometimes things don't work. And often people don't know how the technology they use every day works in the first place.
That's true.
You know, just like I couldn't explain to you offhand how precisely to the letter my smartphone works. Somebody using something like, let's say, you know, artificial gravity or interfacing with an artificial intelligence program, they might use it every day, but not know how it works and get frustrated when it breaks. So I think that's a quality to technology that's not going to go away anytime. So yeah, that was important for me to keep in there.
There's a charming sequence that I just ran into where Jane's new friends, if you will, are helping her feel okay with the fact that she can't really read. And
right,
the way you handled that was with such empathy and sympathy. I'm hoping that was fully intentional as we deal with our technology and what's coming at us, this feeling of uncertainty and dread that comes with that new technology, you handled just deftly.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I think thinking back about that scene, you know, it's important for us, I'm talking in the modern day as well, to remember that people have varying levels of aptitude, you know, when it comes to everything. And in Jane's case, she's very savvy about technology and how that all works. But you're right, she can't read. And I wanted to have some people in her life who were open to that, you know, who are like, yeah, you're really good at this one thing and we'll help you out with this other one.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's so important with technology. You know, I used to, before I started writing fiction full time, I worked as a technical writer, basically translating, you know, software engineer into everyday human speak.
Right.
And I think empathy is important. You have to remember that not everybody lives and breathes this stuff every day, you know, and that sometimes you just got to start with the basics, and that's okay. You don't want to make people feel stupid. So I'm glad to hear that scene worked in that respect.
Oh, it totally does. It stood out to me in a way, and full disclosure, I've not finished the book because I'm reading this one slowly, frankly, because I'm enjoying every page. But that one really stood out to me as kind of like, hey, all hands on the rope. We can do this kind of thing. It was very well done, and I very much appreciated the level of skill that went into it. let's pivot away from your days as being a human API, right? Taking technical writing and making it accessible to the masses. Let's talk about how you got into writing full-time fiction. What was your first book, and how did that come about?
Sure. My first book, The Long Way to a Small Angry Planet, and it has a sort of topsy-turvy path to publication. So when I was working on it, I was freelancing at the time, mostly technical writing, but also some essays and whatnot online. And like I'm sure many freelancers can relate to, ran into a gap. You know, I'd run out of paying work at this point, and I had two more months until my next gig was lined up. And I really wanted to be able to, you know, eat. So I started a Kickstarter campaign. And I said, you know, here's the book, here's what I'm working on. I need two more months of writing time to get it finished. And to my eternal surprise, it was successful. And so I finished out the book, and I self-published to, you know, get it in my backer's hands, and kind of figured that was it. 6 months or so later, had a chance encounter at a convention with the woman who would become my editor, and yeah, it was just one of those difficult to replicate situations of I really did just get lucky. And so the first book did well, and A Close in Common Orbit was my second, and that did well also, I'm very happy to say. So so I was able to you know, eventually, at that point when I wrote Close in Common, I was actually working full time at a software company, so I had to sort of sneak it in the evenings after a full day. So hopefully, knock wood, that was the last time I'll have to juggle two things at once. Now I'm lucky enough to be able to write books full time.
It's got to be a great feeling when your side hustle becomes your main hustle. You know what
I'm
saying?
Yeah, it was. You know, that was always the goal. That was always what I hoped for. But I'm still, you know, I've been without a day job for a year now, and I'm sort of still pinching myself over it.
That's fantastic. And you were listed for the Clark, the British Fantasy Award, the Tiptree, the Baileys, lots of awards for both of your efforts. And we're talking today, of course, about A Closed and Common Orbit with author Becky Chambers. I want to get a little macro just for a second, because like I told you in the pre-interview, my producer has already finished the book. I am well on my way to about halfway through it. And we just kind of were bogged down in a little bit of how do you get to this point? Like, how does the society in the book differ from the society of today? Or what kind of fractures, fissures maybe, did you find an opportunity for fiction to seep in and help us explain and make sense?
Well, I think the most important part of writing any future is to remember that it's not a monoculture, right? And that was really important for me in creating this setting, in that humans are not all the same. You know, we don't all live in the same place anymore. So we have lots of different cultures and subcultures, and the same is true for the alien species that we share the galaxy with. You know, it's common in science fiction, and I definitely do this a little bit as well, to say that, oh, well, you know, this one species is like this all the time, or the people from this planet are like this all the time. And to some degree, you can see a little bit of sense in that. Like, if you're going to cooperate to a degree that you're able to have an intergalactic civilization, you need to have some cultural coherence. But I do think it's also important to show that people are different, and people with different ideas go different places. In the context of the character Jane, who lives in a society who is very estranged from the mainstream galaxy, I wanted to show that, you know, there still are humans out there with really repugnant ideas, and who would be shunned and who would be turned away. And yet, because we have access to the galaxy as a whole, you can just kind of pack up and go to a new planet if that's the case. Mm-hmm. You know, you can carve out a niche for yourself, and space is big enough that the rest of us can say, all right, you're over there doing your weird thing, and we'll turn a blind eye, which turns out to not actually be the greatest thing, because if in Jane's case, or her fellow people who are being exploited, you know, nobody's doing anything about it. And so I wanted to, I don't dive into it too much, but I wanted to sort of subtly bring that up, that idea of at what point do you intervene? At what point do you step in and say, no, this is not okay? Or do you just say, you know, live and let live, I don't like it, I'm going to put it over there? I think something we in our own society do a lot of, you know, like, oh, we disapprove of what you're doing, but, you know, you're really far away, so we're not going to worry about it. And I don't, you know, have a stance, at least in my work, you know, very strongly one way or the other on that. But I do think it's something interesting to think about. You know, at what point are we responsible, and at what point are we too big for our britches, kind of thing.
Well, that approach obviously lends a lot of depth to your characters. And to that point, some of your characters one specifically, there's a lot of artificial intelligence going on. So you had to do a lot of world building around AI and how it applies to society and human interaction with technology. I'm wondering what you think about AI right now. Is it coming faster than we saw? Because your approach to it, and my quick follow-up that I'm going to not wait for your answer, and I apologize, but I got excited. But it seems like your approach to me is the most realistic slash fictional, but still realistic approach to AI, which is still freaking out a lot of people.
In terms of our, you know, where it is today, I don't think we need to freak out about it quite yet. I do see, you know, every so often you see an article about, you know, oh, we taught an AI to lie or to, you know, whatever, and people get freaked out. You know, we haven't yet taught a program how to think. We can teach them to do very specific things, but beyond that, I don't think we have to worry about the robot wars or anything anytime soon. But in terms of my setting, we're talking about a context in which AI are not considered full citizens. They're not considered people by the mainstream. There are a lot of people who disagree, but they are seen as tools. They're seen as something we built and something we made, and therefore it's okay to treat them like this. You know, and there is a recognition of their sentience, but we treat it sort of the way that you would treat, I don't know, a pet or a dog, a horse, something like that, you know, where you recognize that they're intelligent and there are laws dictating their ethical treatment, but you're not going to let them vote. You're not going to let them walk around and do whatever they want, like they're still your property. Right. I can very much see us going in that direction, you know, if we were to get to the point where we could make artificial intelligence that could think and reflect on things. I do think we'd be scared by it. Obviously, my stance in the book is that you don't need to be, but right. I think with as much pearl clutching as we already have over, you know, computer programs beating humans in chess or what have you, I definitely think that's the way we would go.
Right. I tend to agree with you. I think that artificial intelligence should be allowed to do what it's really good at, and humans should be allowed to do what they're really good at, which is mess things up and trial and error and be creative and that kind of thing. That was Becky Chambers. She is the author of the award-nominated science fiction novels The Long Way to a Small Angry Planet and A Closed and Common Orbit. That's the one we're talking about today. She also writes nonfiction essays and short stories, which can be found in various places around the internet. Becky Chambers is a good place to start on Google. Please go to KGORadio.com/techonomics, though, and look for the story that accompanies this week's show. In that article, there are links and more resources for what we talk about here. Coming up after the break, part two of two with Becky Chambers, in which I have to ask a question that I'm embarrassed I still have to ask.
Yes, we want to talk about this. This is important. This needs to be brought to the light. And on the other hand, we all just kind of wanted to talk about spaceships and elves and stuff.
That's next on Techonomics. I'm Jason Middleton. Please, come on back.